There we go. No, go ahead.
It's Thursday, December 15th, 2016. This is Debbie Rumley, and I'm talking this evening with Paul Reiser of Motown and Funk Brothers fame. How are you, Paul?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
So, can you tell me a little bit about where you were born and what it was like growing up in Detroit?
I was born in Detroit in 1943, and Detroit was an exciting place at that time. Very active, you know, an active environment. A lot of people were doing things. There's a lot of activities. There's a lot of jobs, job opportunities, more so than it is now. It was a good, exciting place to be around in.
What was the music scene like at that time?
The music scene was also exciting. There were many, many outlets for musicians, more so than it is now, in the way of nightclubs and places to where they could play there. It was mostly a jazz environment at that time, as opposed to hip hop and R&B as it is now. So it was quite a few good outlets. Yeah.
I know you got your start pretty young in music. How did you get involved in music?
Well, I always enjoyed music, primarily classical music, but I had an instructor by the name of Harold Arnaldi, who allowed me to take up music in elementary school, Keating Elementary, and I took up trombone of all instruments with my short arm. You have to have a pretty long arm to reach all the positions. There's seven positions, and it was years before I could reach the seventh position. I could only go to six because of my short arm. But I did eventually grow to utilize that seventh position.
What made you decide to go with the trombone?
That's a good question. I think it was just the excitement of seeing things, the slide go in and out. And if I had it to do all over again, I would pick something different.
Was your family musical?
My mother was. And she was a keyboard player. She played a lot of gospel music, and that's it. We had a piano at the home, and we used to always hear her play hymns and sing to herself. And I had an older brother who also played piano, and he read very little, but he just had a feel for piano. And I had a brother who was 1 year older who was really an accomplished musician who taught me much about music as we were growing up.
So I didn't realize the GAR building hosted musicians, and you mentioned you got your start in the GAR building at 9 years old. So how did that come about?
Well, my instructor felt that I was coming along good enough to join what was known as the Parks and Recreation Boys Band. That's what it was called at the time, and we had uniforms, and we played concerts at Belle Isle at the Shell, and we played for the Soapbox Derby in Ohio, and we went to camp, and all this was as a teenager. And he felt that I was accomplished enough to sit in the band, so that's where I started at 9 years old. Yeah.
Did they have a band at the GAR building?
Oh, yes. Well, the Parks and Recreation Boys Band.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And no girls, all boys. we just had a lot of fun. And some of the members that we had at that time, I still connect with today, here in 2016. Yes.
That's great. Who or what were your biggest influences as a child?
I think that sports was one of my big influences. We didn't watch much TV growing up. I can remember that. But sports, some organized sports. I played baseball, organized sports, but primarily music. And I was a jazz buff, and a classical music buff.
So I read that your original intentions were to play with the DSO. And I know you've mentioned that you hated R&B, so I'm just wondering what made you decide to start playing with Motown and what sort of changed your mind?
Well, it's true that I hated R&B, yes. I had a friend who attended Cass Tech. He was like a year in advance of me. And he graduated and went to Motown. A fellow by the name of Dale Warren, who wrote a lot of music himself. He's no longer with us. He passed on a few years ago. But he called me to come in and play a recording session on trombone. They were one musician short of, so they needed a trombone player, and I was called for that. That's the reason I got started at Motown. Otherwise, I would have been playing classical music or jazz or anything but R&B music.
So that one mm-hmm. experience sort of changed your mind?
It did, yes.
So moving on from that experience, how did you get introduced to Berry Gordy?
Well, Berry being a musician himself, he was a songwriter and played a little piano. He had a company that was like, I guess you could say, R&D, research and development type company, where he allowed people to just come in, and if they had talent, he had an open door policy with us. And I was one of those people right out of high school. And he would always come in and like to listen to what the musicians were doing. He always loved to congregate with the musicians. So he would come to the studio and listen to us. And that's how I met Berry, actually. And he took an interest in me from the beginning, yes.
So how did the Funk Brothers develop from that meeting and evolve to become the backbone of Motown?
Well, the Funk Brothers were, first of all, a club band, primarily jazz, and we had an A&R director by the name of William Stevenson, William Mickey Stevenson, who brought the band members to Berry one day. And by the musicians being jazz musicians, they weren't necessarily R&B players. So when they came in, they had to learn to play R&B music. And by the mixing jazz with R&B, the Motown sound was developed with the Funk Brothers sound. So that's how that came about.
So was your family supportive of your choice to go with R&B and Motown over your path of classical music?
Yeah, it wasn't so much the family as it was as much as it was my mother. I came from a very religious background, and my mother thought that was the devil's music. That's what she used to call it, okay? Jazz or R&B. So we didn't have much of that at the house. But once I got associated with Motown and successes started coming, the family kind of got behind me and gave me a lot of support, yes. Even my mother and my father, yes.
Did they listen to what you guys were creating?
Not necessarily so, because I didn't bring it home so much. Because I was primarily a musician at that time, as opposed to arranger, orchestrator, conductor, so I didn't bring a lot of the music home. But then, as my career progressed, I invited my parents to a recording session, and they enjoyed it. And if I had known how much they enjoyed it, I would have invited them many years earlier, but they enjoyed it very much.
Oh, that's great. Do you ever think about what your career might have been like had you stayed the course of your classical intentions?
Well, yes. My first love is classical music to this very moment, okay? That's the foundation of me being able to perform other music, is I had great classical training. So I listen to classical music every day, just about all day, to this moment. So I think I would have been a trombone player in one of the symphony orchestras in our country. If not locally, I would have ventured out to another city. But I would have been playing classical music on trombone, yes.
So after you switched gears and started playing with Motown, how did it feel when you started getting praise and recognition for some of the hits, such as My Girl or Papa Was a Rolling Stone or Heard It Through the Grapevine?
Well, just to be frank, me along with the rest of my fellow musicians and orchestrators and conductors and arrangers, we never knew we were making history, first of all. We just did music for the sake of doing music and enjoying what we did. And little did we know that we would be making history as it is known today. We had no idea. We didn't do it for the sake of money. We just did it because we loved music.
So how does it feel looking back on all of that now, like knowing that you're a part of history?
Well, we're proud. Everybody's proud to have been a part of that. Everybody. It's just too bad that some of the musicians who passed on at their early age didn't get a chance to really enjoy the laurels or the what their toiling and their hard work, how it's paid off today. They didn't get a chance to enjoy it. They died at an early age. Mm-hmm. But we're in remembering them, we always speak on them. You know, we never let them be forgotten.
So how does it feel being a Funk Brother?
Well, that's a funny thing because I didn't think I was a Funk Brother. I just know that for years that I associated with them. I enjoyed being taken into the fold as far as they're concerned, because they don't just accept anybody in their grouping, okay? So Berry Gordy certified me to be a Funk Brother as my career progressed, you know? So I'm a certified Funk Brother, yes. And I enjoy it, yes, proud to be. Oh, yes.
So I've seen some of the documentary Standing in the Shadows of Motown. So how did it feel to be back together with the Funk Brothers after 41 years?
Well, it was good to see them, because I always say them, because I feel like they were the foundation and I just became a part of that foundation. So I speak first for them. Everybody was proud to it was a hard toiling to get the film made. It took approximately 15 years to get the film made, okay? Piece by piece by piece. And some of the members passed away before the film was finished and put into the marketplace. So they didn't get a chance to enjoy it, but their families, the heirs, are proud that they were a part of that, that they're a part of history.
Why did it take so long to make that?
Well, there was a lot of agreements to be made, and people wanted everybody wasn't on the same page, let's just put it that way. So it took a lot of pulling here and there for the producers and the film company. And it was finally got done, though, and we're all proud of it, yes.
So I know that you love the Cass Corridor, and you lived on Selden Street. So what was it like in the Cass Corridor in the heyday of the 60s and Motown? And I know you mentioned you didn't live there at that time, but
right. Can
you tell me what it was just like being in the presence of all of that?
Well, you know, as a young professional and as I grew in the business, I always heard of the Cass Corridor, but it always had a negative connotation to it for many, many years. But once I moved in there, which was around the 90s, early 90s, I saw the potential. I met a lot of the people there, and I saw the potential of the Cass Quarter. And it was just starting to bud at that point, to the point where it is today. It's a great area. It's a culturally strong area. And I was proud to be a resident. Yep, I was very proud. And of course, Wayne State always had presence there.
How do you feel about the Cass Quarter and what it's become now?
Oh, I'm very proud to have known and seen the growth, experienced the growth of it, see, and seen how it's transformed. And one day, hopefully, I can move back down there because it's just that vibrant. And I'm excited about it, yes.
There's a lot going on.
Yes.
So you mentioned that Motown was like a family. So what was it like, how did it feel being embraced by that family and brought into the fold and just evolving with that?
Well, at the time, like I said before, we didn't realize we were making history. We just did a lot of the creativity. We created music and did productions because we enjoyed doing it. We loved what we did. Not for the money. Of course, as we grew older, we wanted more money. But Berry Gordy was smart enough to put a group of people together at a young age and let them just exploit their talents, grow their talents at his expense. And we all grew as a family would, like in a neighborhood, like your neighbors across the street or next to you or down the street. That's where we were at Motown. And we had fun. And today, even to this day, the ones that are still around, we still consider ourselves a Motown family. We call us the Motown Alumni Association now.
Do you get together with them?
Oh, yes.
On a regular basis?
Not on a regular basis. That's going to take place once the Motown Museum is established in its new home. We'll get together more on a regular basis, yes.
Nice. And you just mentioned, you said you felt exploited at times. Did you feel as though you were being exploited?
Yeah, as I grew older and we grew wiser to the business of entertainment, the actual business, this business of music, it's called, percentages become important, how much we're getting paid weekly, how much royalties we're going to receive, why we didn't receive certain royalties. You start asking the right questions. But the benefits outweigh the ability to make money, the benefits of creativity and just the enjoyment of it all.
So you said at the start of your career, you had three contracts with Motown. So I guess feeling exploited leads me to this. Why did you have three contracts and did that affect your creativity and productivity?
Well, the reason for the contracts, first of all, is because people believe in your talents, number one. And they saw that my talents were blossoming. I went from a musician on trombone up through maybe 1964, late 64, early 65, to a music copyist. No contracts at this time, though. Then I went to, they signed me as a writer, and that was my first contract. Then they signed me as a arranger, orchestrator, conductor. That was my second contract. And then I graduated to the art of production. So it was a progression. You know, I grew into them. So they recognized my talents and they tied me up, simply put.
Can you tell me about your affiliation or experiences with United Sound?
Yeah, United Sound, first of all, has a greater history than even the Motown Museum does. United Sound Barry Gordy used to record at the United Sound before his company became a world-renowned company. Aretha Franklin used to record over there. Muddy Waters, many blues singers, a lot of the big bands used to record over there, Duke Ellington, Count Basie. United Sound was the place. They did a lot of commercials for the big three at that time, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler. United Sound was a pioneering company long before Motown was even thought about. And so, So as I grew into my career, I started doing projects over there more and more after I left Motown. When Motown left Detroit in the 70s, I started doing more projects over there because I was independent. And United Sound had such a bevy of engineers, great engineers, and then the room itself had a high ceiling, which was great for doing strings because the sound traveled up. And it's to this day the best room in the city for doing strings.
People still do strings there?
Not at this point, because it changed ownership so much. And the physical building is there, but the history of it and the history and the memories are kind of fading. But the physical building is still there, but nobody uses it. No.
Was it better for other instruments as well?
It was good for rhythm sections and horns, yes. And good for vocals too, because of the room size, the sound could travel, yes.
So I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about some of the friendships and the relationships that you developed with some of the people at Motown, and I know you're still good friends with Stevie Wonder.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering if you can tell me about your relationship and friendship with Stevie and perhaps some of the other people that you've had long-standing working relationships and friendships with.
Well, I was so young when I came to Motown. They kind of, Stevie and I both, he was much younger than I. I met Stevie when he was 11 years old. I just turned 18. So we formed a relationship at that time, he and I. But the people kind of took us under their wings because we were so young. Like they treated us like they were like guardians over us for the most part. So we kind of grew as a family, and like from Barry Gordy right on down, his whole family, some of the other people, some of the artists who are no longer with us, like the Four Tops, the Temptations, Diana Ross, whom I went to high school with, the Marvelettes, the Velvettes, Martha Reeves, I could just go on and on naming them. Mm-hmm. But we all formed that relationship, that bond that exists right to this day.
Who are some of the people you're closest to?
Martha Reeves, Stevie, of course, Duke Fricare of the Four Tops, Otis Williams of the Temptations, Diana Ross, Mary Wilson of the Supremes, Holland Dozier Holland, the production team, just to name a few.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow, that's great.
The list goes on and on. Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of the projects you've done with some of these people, or?
Yes,
some of
your course, I enjoy working with Stevie. He's like one of the few pure geniuses we've had in the whole industry of the music business. He's one of the absolute pure geniuses. I enjoy working with him. I've done so much work with him, Science Will Delivered, Rocket Love, just to name a couple, Do I Do, we almost won a Grammy for that song as co-writers. Astrid and Simpson I enjoyed doing. I did Valerie Simpson and Nick Astrid wrote so many great hits. Ain't No Mountain High Enough, Reach Out and Touch, I did their arrangements when they first came to Motown. I did all of their arrangements. And I'm in touch with Valerie Simpson even to this day. I've been knowing her for 45 years maybe. And great talent. Of course, Holland Dozier Holland, of course, whom I named. Norm Whitfield, I enjoyed doing projects with him and the Temptations. We did like Papa Was a Rolling Stone and Cloud Nine and numerous hit songs. So it's, the list goes on and on. Yeah.
Do you have any stories you'd like to share about any of those projects?
Yes, particularly with Stevie. When he was a young guy, he really knew the layout of the Motown studio better than everybody else, even though he was blind. But we used to always tease him, tap him on one shoulder and duck and whatnot, and he would just move around. He never bumped into walls, but he was always chasing us around the building, you know. And we talk about that, we laugh about it to this day even. But he was really a genius as far as music and knowing his way around, and he always had that instinctive, just as his genius, and he had a second instinct, just a natural instinct to know where people were, who they were, and he knew the business that well and knew people's nature, that he could automatically just feel things about people in the room without even talking to them. Just listen to their voices. He just had second nature instincts, yeah.
What was the last project you guys worked on?
He and I, we did, I think it was Rocket Love. He did a project which wasn't that successful about 8 years ago, which was his last CD, as a matter of fact. But he is also working now on a gospel CD, which I want to be a part of, and he's going to help me become a part of. He and I have discussed it, so I'm looking forward to working that project with him.
That's actually my next question. What projects do you have in the works?
That's one of them. Stevie's gospel project, and the artist named Kim, the male, he's looking to do his next project. So I'm looking forward to that one. Mm-hmm. And also. Of course, we know Stevie Wonder and President Obama are great friends. They used Science So Delivered, which is one of my arrangements, as President Obama's theme songs during his candidacy. And so I'm proud of that. But as far as new projects coming, I'm going to be working with the Detroit Symphony. An ensemble from there. We're going to do a string project, solo string project. So that's going to be one of my ventures.
Is that a project with Stevie Wonder also?
I want to bring Stevie in to be a part of. He's already expressed that he would love to be a part of that. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Has he done anything with the DSO?
Oh, for sure. For sure. Every time he... in fact, up until maybe 7-8 years ago, he would come back in town to do his recordings with the DSO. But since living on the West Coast, he doesn't have a lot of opportunity to come this way, so he's done a lot of his later things with the West Coast Strings. But oh yeah, he still loves the DSO, absolutely.
How often do you guys get together?
We do more phone getting together at this point. But when I go to the West Coast, I'll pop by his studio maybe and see him when I get to the West Coast, you know. Yes.
So how has your music evolved since Motown, or how have these various projects over the years affected where you're at now?
Well, of course, you know, Motown has its own sound and its style and whatnot, but as I gained independence in the marketplace, I did music for other major record companies, Atlantic Records, Columbia, 20th Century Fox, RCA, and working with their producers and writers and songs, I was able to grow musically and always approach music from a classical position. So I maintained my style as I grew in other genres and different aspects of music.
Can you tell me more about the music that you're currently working on with some of the folks from the DSO as well as the Detroit Opera Theater? Can you elaborate on some of those projects?
There's one project in particular that Stevie Wonder and I had discussed. It's a project that actually Stevie debuted in the Library of Congress. It's called Sketches of a Life, which is an opera that they commissioned Stevie to write, and I was the orchestrator for that and conductor. But he wants to come back here to Detroit and do it with the DSO. So that's one of the projects that he and I are discussing, ongoing, yes.
So how do you feel about the current music scene in Detroit and what it's kind of come to right now?
Well, it's contemporary, I'll put it that way. It's a far cry from when I was growing in the business. The musicians take a different approach to music now. It's more electronic, and it's not as creative as it was when I was coming along. There's a lot of sampling, which is, of course, electronic. It's borrowing other people's ideas and creating other songs from other people's ideas, which is something we didn't do coming along. But it's just the nature of things, that's growth. But it's a difference, it's a huge difference, yes.
You mentioned you think that current music is disposable, and I know you're a huge advocate of the arts and arts education. So what is the role you think art and music education can play in encouraging young people to be more creative, to create better music? To go back to the roots.
See, first of all, music is like the common language in the world. There's no other thing that brings people together more than music, you know. If you take, even from the symphonic level, Germany, Russia, Russian composers, German composers, Chinese composers, Japanese composers, they all get along because the music, classical music, is so common throughout the world. The way it's produced, the way it's performed, is a standard throughout the world. So that's why I call it the common language of the world. And I think that through music, we can bring peace in the world, actually. It's a lesson for everybody, politicians and socially and culturally and everything. If we just look at what's happening on the music scene, it could bring people together. Now, as far as disposable music, a lot of it is the songs being written in many cases are not songs that are going to be around and remembered, such as standards that we think of as standards now. That are 30, 40, 50, 60, 70. Some of the classical standards are like 200 and 300 years old. Mm-hmm. The music nowadays is disposable music, literally. They just do it, it lasts for 2 or 3 months in the marketplace, and it's gone,
yeah.
And they come up with more. And it's disposable, it lasts 3 or 4 months, and it's gone. and not remembered by the masses. But it's making money, so that's what keeps it established. That's what keeps it coming. But me, myself, and a lot of other people are purists when it comes to music. And I don't conform to the way music is going now. I'm what they call old school, when I'm proud to be, you know. I'm going to maintain that standard of good music as long as I can.
Are there any trends that you see that you like? Anything happening that you think is good?
That's a good question. And I have to say honestly, no, not really. Like I said, I'm old school and I'm going to be conformed to the standards and the old, true, tried and true music. I'm going to stay in that establishment. I'm not conforming to what's new is not always good. Okay? So I'm old school, will always be.
Have you ever taught music?
Yes, but I was disappointed because the students are being taught at grade school level or into many college levels also. Mm-hmm. The theory of music, which is foundational, and the theory of classical music, and it's foundational to things that they want to do now. It's foundational to creativity and getting the most out of your creativity. They're not teaching it. So when I started teaching at community college level, I had a whole room of students who didn't know music. It's like an English teacher trying to teach language, trying to teach English, and students don't know the alphabet or don't know the meaning of words. It's impossible to teach them almost, see? So I was disappointed, but I'm going back and try to resurrect the theory of music in the school system. I think it's lacking in a lot of cases. It's too slow to it should have never left, first of all. And it's too slow to be regenerated. It's happening, but it's too slow, I think. And musicians, they think that making money is more important than learning the theory and the language of music, see, the pure language.
Did you have any success stories, any students that you saw a real spark in?
In an indirect way, yes. People have come to me over the years, and musicians, and tell me how I influenced, through my writing, how I influenced them to approach music in the way that I did. See, every musician has a style. I established my style because of my classical training, and that's what holds me steady in the marketplace, where my style stands out. So I've had a lot of people, yes, to this day, they call me because they're grateful that I established that music in the marketplace and it gives them something to grow with.
How does that make you feel?
Proud, you know? Oh yeah, and I don't do it for that purpose, but it's just that it comes with the territory. You know, when you do good things and right things, you get accolades, you know?
How do you think art and music education can affect a young person's life?
Well, I think that the arts, first of all, they affect your brain and learning processes, period. For academics, what it does, take music. Music is a mathematical, even if a person doesn't know theory, they're still doing math because music is so many beats per bar, so many beats here and there, and it's all got to come together. They're doing math and they don't realize they're doing math, but it affects the brain, it affects academic learning. And a lot of the administration in our schools, they don't realize the connection. So I think that the sooner they bring music back into schools I guess what you call it not an academic, but a secondary thing, but an important secondary, okay? Every student should take a choir or a musical instrument and whatnot, because it would help them to establish something academically, a little more strength academically. And it's got to come back to that.
So I know you got your start, obviously, pretty young. What differences do you see in the music education that you received and the music education that is available now?
Well, I think the instructors, they want to do well. But unlike when I came along, the budgets were in place, the budgets were good, they could attract the proper people to come and apply for jobs. But right now, the budgets aren't there for them to attract the really, truly dedicated people as instructors to come in and teach in the direction or in the manner that I was taught in. So the dedication is not there with the instructors simply because of the budgetary problem.
Are your children or grandchildren musically inclined?
Oh, yes. All of my grandchildren, as a matter of fact. My oldest, who is Brittany Bond, she's 30 years old at this point. Since the age of about 11 years of age, I should say. She has been able to pick successful people as writers, as artists, as producers. She hasn't been wrong in picking a person in the marketplace, people who are successful. She would pick them without even thinking twice about it. And that's just her instinct. She knows musically from her instinct. Now I have grandchildren who are 5 years old, twins. They attend a school for the gifted called the Roper School. And they are taking music. They're taking musical instruments, and I think they're taking dance and they are advancing. My granddaughter, who is named Sydney, 5 years old, she wants to be a singer and a trainer at this point. And it's a natural instinct. And my her brother, who is a twin at 5 years old also, he has musical instincts also. So yes, all my grands have some kind of a musical instinct, yes.
So how did it feel taking your granddaughter back to the GIR building where you got your start?
Yes. Oh, that was wonderful. And we went back there at a time when the building is being truly renovated. They were knocking out walls. They were putting in floors. They were putting a roof on. She and I actually went in and helped to tear out walls and whatnot. So we are part of that new Renaissance history. But it felt real good, brought back a lot of memories because it was, like I said, I was 9 years old when I first started there. And I spent 9 years in the building, and it was wonderful.
What were some of the memories?
Oh God, how we used to take the raggedy elevator upstairs. Okay, how old the building was, and how we used to sit in a band, and we used to exchange stories. Our parents used to bring us and take us. Just a lot of old memories, you know, as children. Yes.
Um, what are some of the projects that you've got coming up?
Well, there are music projects always coming along, and I'm very specific about projects that I take on. They have to have a quality to them, a certain quality, and I just finished a project that was out of Memphis, Tennessee, an independent gospel project, which was a good one. And that was a Doc Pearson project, which we should see on the marketplace pretty soon. Wonderful project.
So you're still being recognized and awarded for your many accomplishments. How do you feel about all of this?
Well, I'm proud. Yes, I'm very proud. And people, they recognize me from a lot of walks of life for my accomplishments. All the work has paid off, you know, all my 54 years in the business, I should say.
Wow.
It's paying off, yes. Mm-hmm. Not a hard work.
Can you maybe tell me some of your most favorite or most interesting projects that you worked on throughout your career?
Yes. The Stevie Wonder Project, which was a story of his life in music, actually, which is what the opera is. That was a sketches of a life. That was a great project, big project. It was like an opera. That project, of course, R. Kelly's project, I Believe I Can Fly, which is a great project. Ain't No Mountain High Enough, of course, with Diana Ross, great project. I just go on and on. You know, I've done film projects, film scores, Richard Pryor, Which Way Is Up, I've done. I'm very proud of. Those are just to name a few.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I probably should have asked this a little earlier, but did your career change at all when Motown moved to LA?
Yes, it did. It made me realize that I have to do a lot on my own. I couldn't depend on the corporation to set a stage for me. I had to go out and get to work on my own. And but just so happened, by Motown having so many hit records, your work speaks for you more than you going out knocking on doors. What you've got in the marketplace, in other words. So those hit records are what people use. They call me because of the work that I've done, my body of work. So I was fortunate in that respect, and that's how I expanded my latitude in the marketplace, by people calling me based on my work of the past.
How did the music scene change when Motown moved here?
It was at Detroit, yes. It really changed. It was like a drop, okay? Because Motown was the star in the city. It was the music foundation in the city, and it was a big letdown for a good while. It was a shock to everybody, but of course, you know, we have to adjust and move on.
So how do you feel about the expansion of the Motown Museum?
Oh, I can't wait. Yes, because what it's going to do is allow more people to come and see the museum. For one thing, the exhibits are going to be expansive. It's just going to be a step up from where we are today, you know, and we got a lot of major backing. Corporate backing, and it's going to be wonderful. Yes.
Are you excited to be the recipient of the 2017 Heroes and Legends Award?
Oh, I'm honored. Oh yes. It's been going on. This particular awards program has been going on for about 28 years now. So I'm proud and honored to be recipient. Yes. And I know all of the people who are the directors, Janie Bradford, among others. She is the founder of this awards program. And I'm really proud, yes, to be honored, yes.
That about wraps it up for me.
And I want to thank you.
Thank you for your time. I'm glad we were able to make this work.
Thank you again.